Hi, everybody. Welcome back to The War Room, our interview series as part of the Clone Star podcast. I'm your host, Joe Hurley. This week, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by New York Times best-selling author, Ballykissangel super fan, a man who's written for Indiana Jones, The Simpsons, Iron Man, Star Trek, Star Wars, Battlestar Galactica. I could say that nominated for a Dragon Award, nominated for 4 Scribe Awards. John Jackson Miller, if I keep on going, I don't think the list of all the achievements, accomplishments, things you've written for, your nerddom, I don't think I'd be able to stop.
Well, I appreciate that. And in fact, I won the Dragon Award and I won the Scribe Award. So that's that big pointy thing back there in the background over here. So I was amazed.
Oh, my eyes. Oh, dear God.
No, I was amazed. I was amazed they were actually able to mail it, not just to me, but also to the comic book artist on that, who was in Brazil, managed to get this big piece of glass to them without shattering it on the way. So it was a feat of packing, I think, international travel. Anyway, I'm very glad to be here.
John, you've written so much about all the different kind of, you know, different fandoms and things like that. Now, the only thing is, because this is a Star Trek podcast, if you talk about Star Wars, we may have to bleep you out several times. Now, I say that wearing a New Hope t-shirt as well.
That's quite all right.
John, let's take it all the way back to the start. Where did the love of writing come from? Did you grow up in a literature family? Like, was reading a big part of what when you were growing up?
My mother was a grade school librarian, where other people's mothers threw their comic books away. Mine encouraged me to put mine in order. And so I kind of had that. My father, was in electronics. And so he taught me the science sort of a stuff. Basically started collecting comic books at age 6. I started drawing my own. I started typing my own stories on a typewriter. I had kind of my own universe within comics. Miller Comics presents. Along in that area, I'd seen Star Trek first. I was born the day that the Piece of the Action episode aired for Star Trek back in the original series, so I didn't see that show while it was going on, but certainly it was on in syndication in America quite frequently in the 70s. And then when I'm 9 years old, 9 and a half, that's when Star Wars comes out, and Star Wars more or less dominates my next 3 or 4 years. But by the time Star Wars has just about run its course, well, that is when Star Trek has found its footing on the big screen and with the movies. And so really in that sort of fallow period for Star Wars, that is when my Star Trek fandom, grew a lot faster, because I was able to watch Next Generation as it came out, and all of that.
In the period, say, of the 1980s, obviously it was a wonderful time to be a nerd, because you did have all those big budget movies on the big screen, which then eventually led into, say, the Next Generation. But John, you said that you had the John Jackson Miller comic universe back in the old days and things like that. Like, was it kind of different characters that you had, or one central character, or what were some of the characters?
Everyone thinks that I must have written a lot of fan fiction because I've worked in all these different universes. The fact is, I didn't write any at all. I didn't even know what it was. I didn't know that there was a community out there that was doing this. First of all, I was not a good artist, so I was pretty sure that if I drew Captain Kirk or anybody else like that, nobody would recognize who it was. And secondly, I was a capitalist. I was like, well, I need to own these things. I need to, if they ever come around and make the movie for Star Duck or Dare Duck. I did a lot of things with ducks because I couldn't draw people, but I could draw ducks. Where that sort of led to, my dad got a photocopier for his business, and I started using that to actually, duplicate and distribute some of my things. When I'm 16, by that point, I have discovered a magazine called Comics Buyer's Guide, which was a newspaper. It was a weekly newspaper in the United States. It was from there that I realized that, okay, there is this universe out there, that is doing fanzines. Actually, the very first fanzine I saw was by a friend of mine, Ken Barnes, and his cohort Andy Balog. It was called Stardate Now, and it was just distributed in our high school. And it was a Star Trek fanzine. Yeah. But it was Comics Buyer's Guide that kind of showed me, oh, well, this is how people were actually contacting one another to build these mailing lists, the classified ads. And also there is a market for these small press or photocopied mini comics. There's this whole movement where, amateurs are sending things back and forth. Yeah. And so I continued to do, my comics, on into my college years. It would be just a story a year or so, cause I was not fast at all, but it was sort of a way of participating with that. But then also, in addition to the comics, I remember at age 16, I started a fanzine just within my high school. That came out weekly, and I would just photocopy it and distribute it. And that served me well when I became the editor of my high school newspaper, because I already knew how to do a magazine. I already knew how to do something. And so that led to when I went to college, after a brief flirtation with astronautical engineering, I thought about, hey, I'll build spaceships. And then I realized, hey, I can't do calculus.
Damn that prerequisite of maths in that kind of industry as well.
No, it was a terrible thing. I made the mistake of testing into honors calculus. I thought I was showing off. I go into my very first day of college. I go in and I get, honors calculus lands on me, and I would have dropped the course, except there was this blonde that was sitting in front of me, and I had not yet learned the college rule that you don't actually have to be in classes with people to continue to talk to them at other times.
That was a rule. Oh dear God, I didn't know that.
I ran to the journalism department and I said, hey, I was my high school newspaper editor, take me, as long as there's no math. and they did. And I ended up becoming the editor for the campus newspaper at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. And what was kind of the formative summer for me there was 34 years ago now, 1989. This is the summer where there is Indiana Jones 3. Yep. There's Ghostbusters 2. There's Star Trek 5. And then there's Batman. And I see you have the Batman poster there.
I was about to ask you, how many times did you see Batman in the cinema that summer, John?
That summer, 11, and a 12th time the next year, where it was actually in a big concert hall via setting. So in the theater, I saw it a dozen times. But what I did was, because I was the editor of the newspaper, I was able to assign myself stories as I chose. So I had done all of the, I had interviewed governors and various political types. I interviewed Joe Biden when he was just a senator.
Oh, wow.
It was a wonderful experience. He had run for president in 1988 and had failed miserably at that, actually, because he got in trouble for plagiarizing the words of Neil Kinnock, who was a British
politician. Yeah, I know Neil Kinnock.
Neil Kinnock. Yeah, and he got in trouble for that, and so he was touring colleges doing speeches, and that was kind of cool because they had set up a a press availability for him beforehand. And, you know, I was because he was speaking on our campus. So I did my research and I figured out, OK, maybe I'll get to ask one question. And I show up at this press availability and nobody else was there from the TV stations or the newspapers. Oh. It was just me. And because again, he had lost the election, and that was sort of it. And his handler said, "Well, do you just want to go on with the go to your speech and you just forget about this?" And Biden looked at me and he says, "Have you got some questions for me? I said, "Yeah, I spent some time on this." And he said, "Come over here and sit down." And we ended up doing 20 minutes.
You didn't ask him about plagiarism, Neil Kinnock. Now,
no, John. I didn't ask him about that, but I asked him about everything else I could think of. Because, and again, it was wonderful that he was able to give me that amount of time. Because it was again, most of the I talked about governors and mayors and things. They didn't really talk to the student newspaper folks very much. So anyway, he didn't have to do that, and I thought that was very nice.
So but John, no, I. Politics obviously played a kind of a big part in kind of your life and things.
It does, because what happens here is, to finish the thought about the newspaper, I was able to assign myself movie reviews, and so my very first movie review for the college paper was it probably was Star Trek V. And
did you give Star Trek V, John?
It was favorable. It was favorable. And I didn't realize the things that were iffier about it because there was no internet then. There was no way for the community to get together and say, "Oh, wait, that special effects shot is not real. It's just a cutout or something like that." And then, of course, as I say, Batman, and that leads me toward, you know, okay, maybe I'm more interested in writing about, I begin to think I'm more interested in writing about comics and movies and that sort of thing, instead of just writing, the hardcore journalism stuff. And then the Berlin Wall fell. And this caused me to think, okay, you know, actually, maybe I do need to actually, you know, set aside the comics and the fun
stuff. Stick with the politics while all this is happening.
Yeah, it sort of pulled at me. So I ended up getting a master's degree in Soviet studies from Louisiana State University. And the reason that I did not get a master's is because the Soviet Union collapsed on my dissertation. It was the summer of 1991. I had just come back from, I was actually in the car on the way back from, Indiana University has a foreign language or a Slavic language immersion camp where basically it's a summer program where, you know, you get a year's worth of the language in 3 weeks. Yeah. And I was there for 8 weeks. And so the theory was I was going to finish my master's degree, go off and do my research. And what happened is the coup happened in the Soviet Union. And by the time that week was over, everything that I was planning on studying was gone.
Gone. Oh my God. And were you thinking to yourself, John, this is the worst thing that has ever happened to anybody?
No, because I realized while I was at that Russian language thing that there was a very good chance that if I had to go over for an extended period of time on my own, I would starve because I did not speak the language well enough. I was pretty good at greeting, grammar. I was okay, but
how to direct somebody to the airport or the train station? You were absolutely nailed that one, but beyond that, no.
But by ear, that was just not working for me, and so I was like, okay, well, so and my major professor encouraged me. He said, well, you know, you could still you know, do your studies, because even though the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, you know, I intend to keep studying this, you know, the same Politburo data for the next 50 years of my career. He says it has to do with the study of elites, he said. And I said, okay, well, look, I'm not a historian. Things are moving way too fast to be anything but a journalist over there. I already decided I wasn't going to be a journalist, at least for this. And I said, look, I will, I'll tap out. I'll just take the master's. And so I ended up becoming an editor of trade magazines for the lumber industry. And
we're going in a certain direction with space duck.
Then
we
went into
the politics direction. Now we're working in the lumber industry. John, this is a very fascinating move around.
Well, imagine how I felt. Well, I mean, I'm basically ghostwriting interviews that the salesmen for these magazines, what were they called? National Hardwood Magazine, the Softwood Forest Products Buyer, and the Import-Export Wood Purchasing News. They never saw a magazine they couldn't add words to make the name longer. And so I'm ghostwriting all these articles over the course of about 8, 9, 10 months. I don't know anything about lumber, and I still don't, but I could write about anything. And that was also what I kind of learned in grad school, was I realized, you know, I was not succeeding because I had particularly brilliant ideas about, world affairs. I was succeeding because I was a good writer. And I was succeeding because the packets that I would do, the reports that I would do, would have maps and, you know, things that nobody else had. Yeah. And again, it was because of my publishing background. And so it was actually 30 years ago this month. I had done the lumber thing for just long enough that I knew I had to go, and I pick up an issue of that magazine I talked about, Comics Buyer's Guide, and I see that they are looking for an editor for their trade magazine, the trade magazine for the comics industry called Comics Retailer. It's a sister publication to Comics Buyer's Guide.
And at this point, John, you'd kept on buying your own comics as time.
Yes, I certainly had. So yeah. I'm still a pure fan until this moment. And and then what happened is they called me up for an interview. I flew up to Wisconsin, had lunch with Don and Maggie Thompson, who were the editors of Comics Buyer's Guide, and basically they are two of the founders of comics fandom in the United States. They created the first fanzine. They went to all the first conventions, that meeting went over well. And so basically, as I say, 30 years ago at this time, I was packing, and I moved up here at the just before Thanksgiving, and I have been in Wisconsin ever since. The magazine period there, you know, it starts with me editing the Comics Retailer magazine. After Don Thompson passed away, I started doing more work for Comics Buyer's Guide on the consumer side. We added almost immediately, because the other thing is I was a gamer, so I was somebody who, you know, was into role playing games and card games and everything. Magic the Gathering came out in '93, so. Mm-hmm. We added Magic the Gathering coverage to my magazine, then in 1999, we went out and bought the leading magazine for collectible card games. This is a magazine called Scry, S-C-R-Y-E, which basically every month it would cover, or every issue would cover Magic and Star Wars and Star Trek and various other things. And so that gave me an additional entree to these other franchises. My first Star Wars magazine is actually that I edited was an unofficial or unauthorized price guide that we did. In 1999, in advance of the Phantom Menace coming out.
Coming out, of course.
And so I already have some some, you know, I have working knowledge of what's going on in these franchises. I mean, you know, Star Trek obviously is on TV mm-hmm. again at that point. And you know, really the fiction part of this, I had always wanted to write, but while I'm in that period, which is almost a 10-year period there where I'm almost exclusively devoting my attention to editing, both starting my like family, but also the magazines. And then we spun off books. We did big collectible encyclopedias of things for, you know, price guides.
John, in the most positive way possible, I have to say, you're probably the biggest nerd I've ever spoken to. And it's really cool because you're immersed in absolutely everything. So well, in this 10-year period, did Space Duck ever rear its ugly head again to you saying, I need to go back, I need to finish The Adventures of Space Duck at some point?
Starduck, yeah. Well, you know, not that. But I kept. I did, actually, I take it back. I did have a set of characters that I decided that I would update. I did a small press comic book in 2002. Again, by this point, I have a computer, so the computer is assisting me a bit with the art. And I just did that as a small self-published thing. It was a short run graphic novel called Faraway Looks. And then what happens is literally the day that I get that book back from the printer. I had taken off work that day and I was called at work and they said, we need you to come in because this is a big deal. Our company that had done all these magazines, Krause Publications, we were actually the world's largest publisher of hobby magazines. So collectors magazines for comics and games and toys and records. And
I was ranting about lumber in those.
No, but just about anything else, antiques. Well, antiques have lumber in them, I suppose. So we had all these publications. Well, what happened is we were employee owned. And what happened is that very day that my first comic comes back, my company announced that we had sold out to a private equity firm, which meant that, I was no longer a stockholder. I no longer owned the company. And so all those nights that I was putting in, you know, making these magazines spectacular, I no longer had to do that because I was no longer going to be earning from it. And I basically told my boss, all right, at this point, I'm going to start looking for freelance opportunities to start the next phase of my life. It was something that they were amenable to. And
were you excited or kind of scared at this point, John? Because obviously now this is a big departure where you're kind of, I've been kind of stable. I've had a plan all the way along.
Well, it was something where I knew I had time because it was going to take a couple of years for the buyout to actually play out.
You had security there as well at the same time then. Yeah.
Yeah. So the company wasn't going away. But what happened is, I remember it was the week that it was that winter, the week between Christmas and New Year, I'll never forget. I was about the only person in the office because everybody took off and I got a phone call from a friend of mine who worked at Marvel. And he said, I have the president of the company for you, or the publisher, on the line here. Would you be interested in writing a comic series for us? And I found out that what they were doing is they had a talent search basically, and the first round of the talent search they were going to go first to the people that they knew who were in comics, but not writing comics, or in comics but not drawing comics, because what they were trying to do was see if people could start up a studio on the outside and produce a completed work and then send it to them. Yeah. And I was one of many people who submitted. And when I say many, I mean many. I mean just about everybody I knew in the press set something, and then once they opened it up to the general public, I mean, I went to my Marvel editor's office after all the submissions had come in, and the packets were piled along the wall. it was just hundreds and hundreds of them. But
so
it,
what
it
turned, did you submit, John?
What, like, what was what I submitted? Well, I submitted two things. I immediately went back to my notion for I did the Soviet studies thing years ago, and I said, you know what? I don't think I've really liked any depiction of the Soviet Union or Russia that I've ever seen in comics, because it never felt like you know, the authors had I had not been there, but I had studied it a lot.
Yeah.
Well, what I did was I paired up with an artist named Steve Ellis, who had lived in Moscow for a year. And we submitted, or actually I submitted before we brought him on, I submitted the idea for Crimson Dynamo. Crimson Dynamo, and I think I have the model of him back behind, hiding behind Strange New Worlds back there. But basically, that was the Russian version of Iron Man from the 60s. And yeah. I said, let me update this character for, you know, this post-Cold War era.
Yeah.
And we did. And I submitted that idea and also a Doctor Strange idea. They went with the Crimson Dynamo idea. And so we produced this comic book miniseries that ran six issues. And while it was going on, they said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to hire you to write Iron Man. Oh. And I wrote Iron Man for a year. Mm-hmm. This again was a case where I was bringing in these political things. My claim to fame is that I made Iron Man, or rather, I made Tony Stark the Secretary of Defense. So Tony is almost never in the armor in the comic series, which may have been my Waterloo. I mean, that may have been that was my mistake. But they had been marketing me as this Tom Clancy, you know, figure, because everything that I was depicting, you know, having to do with the military, was real. All the equipment was real. Everything was real. I have sort of a 9/11 style incident happen involving Washington, D.C. Yeah. I'm sending down to my artist, Jorge Lucas, no relation to George Lucas, but he's down in Argentina. So I'm always sending him, you know, these schematics and things, because I'm talking with the Air Force's public relations guy that I know. I've had all this stuff that I've got in, and I'm, you know, the 9/11 style incident, I'm having to send him maps of where I want this plane to go down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember, because again, by this point it's 2003, and I put at the end of the email, okay, for any of you national security agency snoops who are reading this, it is a comic book.
I'm not planning anything. Take me off the list, please. What I'm doing.
Because my artist is down there. I mean, I was happy to send photo visual reference of things like, you know, what does a cheap motel look like in the United States? Yeah. Just various you know, things that we had shown. And I'm very proud of that run. I did what I thought, you know, I approached it like, I figured, you know, I may never get to do this again, so I'm going to write the kind of story I want to see.
Yes.
And even though those comics, most of them still have not been reprinted, they actually have lived a second life, because they sent them all to Jon Favreau when he was doing the prep work the first Iron Man movie. He hired our cover artist, Adi Granov, to design armor for the movie. And they pulled, character names and characters from the books. The reporter in Iron Man 1 and 2, the blonde that interviews Tony Stark, that's, Christine Everhart. That's, she's from our comics. So I created her. And then, also the villain from the comics, and this is just surreal. They ended up pulling that character out This is a political ne'er-do-well by the name of Sonny Burke. She's a Southerner in the United States, and they pulled that character and that name, and they put him as the villain in Ant-Man and the Wasp. Yes. And so 15 years later, more than 15 years, yes, 15 years after those comics come out, Marvel invites me and also Jorge from Argentina up to go see the premiere of the movie. So that was really very cool. Wow. But again, that would have been the end of it. I didn't do anything comics wise after Iron Man ended for a while because I'm figuring out my next steps. At this point, I actually proposed a Star Trek short story, I proposed a Star Trek novella to Strange. It wasn't Strange New Worlds. I did send in a Strange New Worlds contest entry back when they had those. I sent in a proposal to Keith DeCandido, who is running the Star Trek Starfleet Corps of Engineers line. Was the ebook line.
Ebooks,
and,
yeah.
And he accepted one of my outlines, and I would have immediately gone to do that, except the line collapsed. They didn't do anymore. And so I ended up saving that idea and using it for a Star Wars Lost Tribe of the Sith story later. Because I was able to actually, you know, basically file the registry numbers off of it and figure out a way to repurpose it. So the Star Trek didn't happen. But that summer I did make contact with the Simpsons comics folks, and I did a Simpsons comic story. And then I also, and this is really the big thing that happened, was that in the summer of 2004, I paid a call on Dark Horse Comics, in Oregon, and you know, while they're ostensibly with my business and while touring, I spotted Randy Stradley, the editor of the line, as I was heading out. I said, "Can I go say hello to him?" And I did, and I just happened to have my Year of Iron Man, the comics in my backpack.
Oh, lovely.
And he just happened to need a single issue, a fill-in issue, as we call it, a substitute story for a book called Star Wars Empire. I did that, and that came out in the summer of 2005. And they liked it enough that, you know, at the beginning of 2005, Randy asked me to propose a comic series under the name Knights of the Old Republic, which would tie into but not be about the video games that was popular. So I proposed this series about really my own characters within the universe, but I set it 7 years before the video game, so I could draw a few things here and there and use some settings. And that title ends up going 57 issues in different incarnations. In my work with the Star Wars comics leads to me getting Star Wars short stories, and then the short stories I mentioned, Lost Tribe of the Sith. This was a series of connected short stories that we were making available for free online, because this is very early in the ebook days. And they since have been collected in an edition that has now, you know, it's now gone to 20 different printings, so that's kind of a cool thing.
So John, so just out of curiosity,
yes,
in terms of, say, like, obviously Star Trek and Star Wars, there's similarities, but there's also extreme differences and things like that.
That's right.
When you're writing for Star Wars, like, what way do you kind of approach it? Because obviously, like, predominantly with Star Wars, it is kind of like either a story of somebody's character's destiny, or it's good versus evil, things like that. How do you approach kind of where you're going to set it, how you're going to approach it?
Well, you know, to a degree, all of these things, they tell you, hey, we're looking for something to fit here in this slot in the timeline or in the franchise or whatever. And when I'm proposing a story, you know, whether it is for you know, when I was doing The Lost Tribe, then I did Knight Errant, which was both a novel and a comic series, and then the Kenobi novel and the New Dawn novel, any of those things, I would always look at, you know, the plot elements that I'm talking about, and I would say, okay, you know, one thing that I can't do anything where science is central to the story. Yeah. Because science is not central to Star Wars. Star Wars is a space opera. It is a fantasy. Basically everything is the embodiment of the Heisenberg compensators, where we you know, it's a catch-all for, yeah, we don't know. And the thing is, I was always, even then, still trying in my Star Wars work to make things reasonably accurate, or at least real world accurate.
I'm curious about the Kenobi book. And I mean, the reason I'm curious about that most is because obviously it's a huge thing in terms of, at the time, obviously you didn't have the TV series and all that kind of thing. So your book is basically positioned, say, before, A New Hope. It's after Revenge of the Sith and things like that.
Yeah, it's the first month. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very small, it's a very personal kind of story of, you know, of Obi-Wan kind of getting used to his new kind of location and issues with the kind of the tribes and, say,
the Tuscans.
Tuscan Raiders. Yes, exactly. And Plug Eye and all that. Like, when you were being given the kind of brief for that, was it kind of keep it small? We don't need an earth-shattering kind of world ending and all that.
That was an exception to the rule, because that was one that we took to them. That was one that it actually, 7 years before that novel came out, my editor and I just started discussing, what would it be like to do a Western with Obi-Wan Kenobi in it? And by the end of the first email, I had the book. I still have the email where I describe it all. And in five paragraphs, I have everything that would be the book. Yeah. And we were going to do it as a graphic novel for the 30th anniversary of Star Wars in 2007.
Yeah.
And the problem was that every time I revised the outline, it got longer and longer and longer, and until the point where it was a 50-page long outline, and we said, okay, this will never fit in comics. I have to wait until I actually get into doing novels, if that ever happens, which at that point was not even on the horizon. But I basically, you know, filed this story. But even then, at the beginning, I was being mindful of what else was going on in the Star Wars universe. We were concerned, for example, that George Lucas might return to that era.
Yeah.
There was a discussion of a television series, a live action series on ABC at the time. This was before Disney had even bought Star Wars. There was discussion of various things. Some of it was just rumor. We realized, okay, maybe this is a dangerous place to sit. Now, when I ultimately, when I did get the go ahead to write Kenobi as a novel, we had announced the book, and then 3 weeks, I'm starting to work on the actual manuscript, and that's when the news of the Disney buyout happens.
Yeah.
And while I do believe that the Disney buyout may have actually helped green light the novel, because they were starting to focus more on the original characters and not on the outside, the early timeline things. Yeah. Then my panic became, oh my gosh, you know, obviously if they're going to do these prequels, or not prequels, but sequel movies, they're going to have to do something with the timeline of the expanded universe. We don't know what yet. And every time Ellen McGregor talks about, hey, I'd like to do a movie too, I'm like, oh my gosh, our book might not come out. So right up until the end, I'm just like crossing my fingers that the book will come out. The book did come out. As you said, New York Times bestseller. To tell you how close a shave it was, that was the first novel where, when they went to the reprinting of it, it had the Legends banner. Because it was that close. And in fact, I was there in the middle of that because my very next novel was Star Wars A New Dawn, where it was a Rebels prequel novel to the Rebels TV series. That was the first work anybody did that tied in with the Lucasfilm story group, which had been created to manage the universe. Yes. And do I think I could have gotten the Kenobi thing through in that later period? No, probably not. Because they would have been fearful that they would step into something that somebody else had planned, or that they would be, you know, causing an issue. So now, ultimately, the irony is, you know, the director and also Ewan, they both read the novel. The director of the Obi-Wan series and Ewan McGregor, they both read the novel. They both liked the novel. They said in their interviews. They ended up taking an element from the novel for the TV show, which is really cool. And nothing they did overwrote the novel. And so I'm very thankful for that.
The novel kind of exists in its own kind of way then, can't it?
Yeah. So it's sort of there. And again, I think it's greatly overdone, the worry that people have about this sort of thing anyway. I had two scholarly books out this year. There were two university professors that did a pair of books, collections of essays, one on Star Wars and one on Star Trek. And I will never remember the names of the books. So let me grab them here. The Star Wars and Star Trek. Star Trek Essays Exploring the Final Frontier. Star Wars Essays Exploring a Galaxy Far, Far Away. And then they're sort of college level books for people who are, you know, looking for deep analysis. They asked me to write essays for both of them on canon and novels and comics and how they turn in, connect to things and how these things, you know, work together. And again, since I had that grad school experience, I know how to write an essay for scholarly work.
Can I ask you one quick question, John? Actually, you said the Kenobi book was a New York Times bestseller. That was the first time you were on the list, I'm guessing, right?
It was not. They had a list that they had since retired. I was on two lists before that. There was one for mass market paperbacks, which is the little books. And my Knight Errant novel made that list. They had a graphic novel list for a while. And I wrote the first three graphic novels, or co-wrote the first three graphic novels for Mass Effect, the video game. And our first one of those was a number two on that list. So that was a cool thing. The hardcover list is really the one that people pay most attention to. That was what Kenobi made.
And how did it feel to be on that list with Kenobi?
Well, it was a whirlwind anyway. It was a zoo. That was a very wild time because we were promoting it everywhere and everything. And you know, the book was not a book anybody expected. The main critique of it is that it is not the book people expected. You know, there are no Sith Lords in the book. There are no lightsaber fights. There are no space battles.
That's what I love about it, though. One of the reasons I kind of wanted to read it is I was there going, like, I get all that stuff in other movies and other media and other series. I said, I don't want that. I said, I want...
And you got that in the TV show. Yeah, so, exactly. I mean, my story, you know, holds a place, and... You know, I'm just delighted that I got to do it. Again, we went through so much to get to do it, and so you know, the book's celebrated its 10th anniversary here in September or in August, actually. Yeah. So I'm delighted about it. And again, it sort of fits with things. And if people kind of want to take it in, the reason I mentioned these books is because these are issues that Star Trek and Star Wars both have had to contend with. As the ancillary material has gotten relevant or more important. In the past, these things had no connection to anything. Roddenberry is early on the scene, actually, you know, trying to do quality control to make sure that the books, you know, match up with the vision in the show of how the characters interact and also what you see on the screen. So, you know, in the very earliest stuff, You know, you've got, you know, the famously the flames coming out of the back of the Enterprise nacelles in the comic books, things like that. But you know, for many years, the kind of you know, cohesion that's going on is really coming from us, the authors, as we work with each other to try to cohere, to adhere to what's happening on screen.
Yeah.
But what begins to happen is, as we get into the you know, the late 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s, you know, we find that the studios are drawing some ideas from us.
Yeah.
And they're kicking some ideas in our direction. And so, you know, the idea is to basically find some way to let these stories continue to be published, continue to coexist, but not prevent important stories that need to be told from being told. And
it's interesting to say that because I remember I was watching years ago, I watched an episode of The Simpsons. And when I watched the episode, I was there going, wait a second, that is absolutely the story from one of the Bongo comics, which I had at the time. And it was Bart met a rich person and they just who looked exactly like him.
Well, it's Fox owned them. So if Fox wanted to use them, Fox could. And that's really the case with all of this stuff. If they want to use any of it, they can. You know, hopefully it will be, as in the case of Marvel and my character, you know, they'll be with some you know, consideration, get you out to the fly you out to the premiere or whatever. And obviously that's a new era that's all new too.
Yeah.
That kind of consideration for the people that did things in the past. But again, I think that you know everybody's come up with a different way of doing this sort of thing, and I've always felt that and as I talk about it in these books, I suggested the James Bond option for Star Wars because basically, you know, there is no, you know, there's no real attempt to pretend that all of these stories all happened in any particular order. But yet you do see them wink at one another, and so you see, you know, the various people who've portrayed M, you know, their paintings or their photo or their portraits are on the wall in No Time to Die. You've got I call it the Skyfall option, because in Skyfall you've got the car from Goldfinger, which shows up, and the fact that car is there and it's pretty obviously intended to be, it's a cameo, but actually it figures into the action. Does it mean that Daniel Craig met Goldfinger at some point? Well, maybe. I mean, but what, you know, the point is, it sort of invites the reader or the viewer, the whoever, to fill in those blanks.
Make your own mind up about it, kind of thing.
Because the closer you get to making something into an absolute day-by-day diary timeline, you'll realize very quickly, first of all, A, things are not going to fit. B, there are way too many, you know, how many stories of Spider-Man in high school have there been? Well, the answer is there are going to be as many as there need to be. And really the main question is, you know, what order do we read these stories in, if we're choosing to read them in order? And not so much, oh, well, this took 3 days to take place, this took 17 days to take place, this took however many. And then what it does is it falls to those of us who are writing the books to practice some kind of care as gardeners in this field, that we don't plant anything that's going to cause a problem, that we don't use too much soil, that we don't use too much space. And so in Kenobi, for example, even though that book takes place over probably 6 weeks, they're really only in there 5 or 6 different actual incidents. Yep. So you could probably place other things with that character around then easily with no problem. But if you do have from the folks you're working with an imperative, all right, we're going to have you, write this. And this finally gets to our Star Trek. because when the streaming series came out and we began working with, I mentioned the story group in the Star Wars case, in the Star Trek case, we've been working on the streaming series related novels with Kirsten Beyer, who is, she was in the writer's room on Discovery. Yep. She is executive producer of Strange New Worlds, one of the co-creators of Picard. Yep. And she also was an author of Star Trek novels.
Voyage. Yeah, that's right.
The Voyager novels. And so she's sort of been our intermediary, and she's been guiding us to places where, okay, you can write about this. So, it may look like I'm breaking one of my own rules in Star Trek, The Enterprise War, where it takes place over the entire year.
Yes, it's a big kind of sweeping story, isn't it? There's a lot going on.
I was told I could have the entire year where Pike and Spock were during the Klingon War, because obviously they had to be someplace else.
Yeah.
And is there still room in there for, various episodes if they wanted to set something in that time frame later? Yeah, I tried to future-proof it at least that well. Maybe they can sneak out of that nebula for a day or a week or whatever. And this stuff kind of self-repairs. The first novel out of the gate, established a meeting between Burnham and Spock. And then the second season of Discovery basically would seem to preclude that. And so when I'm writing Enterprise War, I have a couple of lines in there where Spock says, you know what? It feels almost like I never met her. It's like I bet she would say the same.
Smooth, very, very smooth, John.
Well, that's at least our nod to, all right, if you need something,
we give it to you. Yes.
Yeah, here it is. And that's the kind of self-repair that we kind of can do in our part of things.
You were working on Star Wars for so long, John. Like, was it always a plan to try and get into Star Trek? Or again, like, how did that just kind of, like, I know obviously you'd done the Star Trek Titan kind of novel.
The irony here is actually my Star Wars editor at Lucasfilm suggested me to Star Trek because Jen Heddle, who is the fiction editor at Lucasfilm, who I worked with for many years, she had worked at Simon & Schuster for years too, where she was editing. She edited Jim Butcher's one entry into into tie-in fiction. He did a Spider-Man novel for Simon & Schuster. She had a number of things, and so she knew Ed Schlesinger, who was the editor, overseeing licensed properties at Simon & Schuster. And when we got to the time where New Dawn was, I can't remember where it was in the process. It might have been right after Kenobi was. It might actually still have been the Kenobi year. I'm not sure. I think at some point in there, it became apparent that the number of novels were going to tick down because we've got this incoming content showing up. And she had suggested me to Ed, and Ed recommended me to Margaret Clark, who is the editor for all my Star Trek books. And Margaret invited me first to do a novella, which is the Absent Enemies book, ebook. And then I did well enough on that she offered me the chance to write a novel, and I had the idea for, Star Trek: The Next Generation takedown ready to go. And, really, the only change from the pitch originally it was The Hunt for Red October with Riker chasing Picard. And then she said, now let's reverse it. And we made it Picard chasing Riker. Because by that point, we were able to use the fact that Riker in the novels was an admiral. And that way I got some additional drama from that, because now the master is chasing the student. And that novel happened, and she came back to me and said, do you want to do another novel? I said, no, but I'll do three. I have this idea for a big taut political thriller involving the main element in the beginning was just the mischief that was created by the illusionists in Star Trek. Connected to the Ardra character from Devil's Due. That's right. And over the iterations, it evolved into a Klingon. The Klingons having a much greater role in it. And then I realized, okay, this book is going to be basically they're going to give me the universe for about 3 months, and I get the whole. And what we'll do is we'll release the novels monthly in real time as the events are happening. And what I'll do is I'll tell the story of what happened to the Krug family, the heirs of Krug,
from Star Trek 3. Yeah.
And then what I'll do is I'll wrap it around the story with the illusionists, and I'll use it as a mechanism to bring Krug back to life. And that was delightful. I have a picture on my wall over here of Christopher Lloyd and me where I handed him the books and said, I brought you back to life. And he said, what? And I was like, yes. So after a fashion. And so that was a trilogy. And again, it was just so hard to do because it was all at once. It was a third of a million words. But I'm delighted with how that came out. By the time they came back after renegotiating the contract, that's when the streaming series were going. And so, I did the Enterprise War Discovery novel.
Yep.
I did the Die Standing novel for Discovery, which is, again, in that case, I was given the story of, okay, tell us what happened to Georgiou in between, the end of season one and when we see her in season two. So her first mission for Section 31.
Yes.
And then that book comes out in the height of the pandemic. not that that's a funny thing, but the funny thing about it was that nobody got to see the book because we didn't get to release it anywhere. And so I'm like, oh no. It's like this book never happened. It won the Scribe Award, but it was like it never happened in terms of people being able to get it. But they came back to me again and said, do you want to do a Picard novel? And I said, on two conditions, it's got to be about Rios, who's the character I find the most interesting, and it's got to be absolutely and only fun, because Enterprise War was a military science fiction novel, and there's a considerable body count to it. And the Georgiou novel, she's leaving a trail of bodies wherever she goes. I had been certain that it wouldn't win the Scribe Award because I said, this book is just way too dark for the times. And I guess I was wrong, but I did say, hey, look, let me do something that's just pure fun where almost nobody dies. And, both Margaret and Kirsten said, absolutely, go ahead. And you can have as much of Rios's, your early days as you want. And I said, okay, I'll take the first two years when he's flying the ship. So I got to tell the story of how he came up with the holographic crew and how he bought the ship and everything else. And I had more fun writing that novel, I think, than I've ever had.
And of course, just to point out for eagle-eyed viewers, over John's left shoulder, you will notice that there is a model of the Lassarina. Lassarina right there.
Well, and I probably spent more time going over the blueprints for that ship, because everything that happens in that ship, I mean, that is the only novel I've ever written where, with the exception of the epilogue, every bit of it is in one character's voice. Every bit of it is in from Rios's point of view. And I wanted to do that because he's a very solitary character through all this time. And I wanted to sort of underline that. But I needed the Lassarina to inhabit this story. And if there was anything I could do to change that book, it would be if we could actually put the blueprints of the book in the, or blueprints of the ship in the book, because I do crazy things in here. I take an automobile and I have it running around in the cargo hold because there's room for that to happen. Not much. I end up dumping it down the well so that it lands in the galley. But again, you'll have fun going through that and say, okay, that's where that is. That's where they are. That's what's going on here.
Question for you then. When you're writing, say, Rogue Elements and things like that, I mean, we've only seen Rios, obviously, in two seasons of Star Trek Picard and things like that. Your kind of brief, your responsibility is to basically, you're effectively telling his story over 2 years. Yeah. How do you kind of decide you're looking at a character, we've only seen him on screen for about 20 episodes at this point, and you're saying, I've got to create an entire kind of personality of this man. How do you, like, what's your thought process? How do you do it?
Well, I've watched the season, obviously. I know where he ends up. Yes. I know what level of growth I can give him and what I can't give him. Hmm. He must not end this book knowing what happened back on the Ibn Majid. He must not end this book knowing the truth. He must not end this book having any sort of he can learn something from the book. There's a major element in here about the previous owner, the Klingon that had owned the ship, and the message that he ultimately gives him from beyond the grave, if you're going to take this life on, it's not good. But ultimately you will find more solace, carrying people than you will find, carrying cargo. And again, that sort of, that's a little nod to the series, which is, that's ultimately what saves him. I'm really looking at the series for character moments. I'm a mimic, so I could kind of figure out what his voice will be. When I sent Robert Petkoff the notes for doing the audiobook, which is just a wonderful audiobook, I said, this man's voice has got to be one of two moods all the time. It's either complete disinterest or growling aggravation and never anything else. He does not get the giggles. He does not anything else. He's just there. And again, I kind of key on various moments when we meet him in the show, he's, already injured and drinking and smoking and everything else. And I'm like, okay, this is, I can get around this guy. And then what I do is I figure out, well, what could I do to annoy him to death? And we decided, okay, in conversation with Kirsten, the notion was, well, maybe let's show let's show him having a crew in the beginning and realizing how much trouble that is, and using that to sort of set up the holographic crew later. And so I do that, and then I look for things that I just want to write about and want to talk about. So again, Picard, again, going back to a piece of the action, we do have this whole subplot that has to do with the mobster planet, the Iotians, And I wanted to write about, you know, basically, you know, cultural contamination as it happened in their case. I wanted to show what they were like 100 and some odd years later. I also decided what I wanted to do was I wanted this to be a book about books, a book about book collecting in the 24th century, and where we could actually get into the question of what does it mean to be a collector of things in a world with a replicator? Okay. As it turns out, the villain in the book that I won't give away if people haven't read it, is somebody who knows a lot about collecting. And should. And again, once I knew that I was able to bring these things in, I was able to go in pretty deeply. I mean, there's probably, if you want to look at it, a statement about non-fungible tokens in this book, because there is a discussion about there's a series of what does it really mean to have a facsimile of the item and not the real item.
So
I got to really wallow in some fun collectible, you know, things that over my years, see some of these issues that I got to bring in, and then I was able to make them story related and then make it funny. And so, you know, getting to write the things and the voices of the characters as well. You know, as I said again to Robert when I'm writing the notes, understand that, you know, when we have the holographic versions of Rios, this character shouldn't sound like he's from Scotland. This character shouldn't sound like she's from Ireland. He should sound like Rios doing the accent of somebody, what he thinks.
Yes, yeah, what they sound like, yeah.
So it's all got to be at a remove. It's all got to be. Nobody should look at it and say, "Oh, well, that's cliched." You know, he's just trying to sound like Scotty, or he's just trying to sound like whatever. No. Yes, he is trying to sound like Scotty, or he's trying to sound like it's his version of whoever it is. So
it's like Sean Connery school of accents, isn't this kind of thing? Like it's in that kind of way.
Yeah, I said the hospitality coordinator is. I said, this should sound like an American game show host on amphetamines. So this is because he is so perky and so happy and wonderful. You're a Klingon. Here, have some gach. Because that's what we have in the show. And
yes.
That is what people want to see. They want to see the main characters. They want to see, to a degree, mimicking them. So that's what I did with the Rogue Elements book. And again, I thought I was done. And then they asked me to write the first novel for Strange New Worlds. And I said, okay, I don't know if you're gonna like what you're gonna get. because I had already done in Takedown, I wrote a novel in which they don't set foot on a planet in the entire book. It's entirely shipboard. And then in Enterprise War, likewise, you know, with the exception of when, you know, we're castaways, we're stranded.
Yes, yeah.
Not very often visiting strange new worlds. We are more often shipboard. And so, and even when we are on Strange New Worlds, we're shipboard. So, because we've crashed. I said, okay, I want to do one Strange New World, just one, and I want to do something where I can do some serious world building. And I started with the notion that Enterprise War was a military science fiction novel. Die Standing was a spy novel. Rogue Elements is a caper novel/mystery. I want to do something. Maybe I'll do a Western now. And I thought that you know, obviously, you know, Pike on a horse, you can't yes. go wrong with that. But then I realized, okay, I don't want to just do that. And I realized that I'd like to tell a story about, a quest, a long trail ride, more or less, a wagon train to the stars. But what I want to do is I want to actually have this story look seriously at a trope in Star Trek. You know, I mentioned the cultural contamination episodes or class of episodes.
Yep.
Well, this is a class of episode about abducted civilizations or abducted peoples. And there's a whole lot of those in Star Trek where people have been grabbed and replaced and grabbed and replaced and grabbed and replaced. I said, okay, well, what if we create this book, which is about a utopia involving these things. So they're not, they were brought to these places not necessarily for negative purposes. In the beginning, it was more of a yes. negative thing. But as we went through every draft and we got closer to it, two things happened. First, we threw away characters that were going to be on the planet. We decided, okay, let's just get it down to four main characters on the planet because mm-hmm. it would have been way too long. It's already my longest novel. It would have been way too long. But then the other thing we did with it is you know, Kirsten kind of said, well, you know, maybe what if we say this utopia still works for most people? It just doesn't work for everybody. And that was kind of my guiding light. That and also, of all people, Anson Mount had done a tweet because he reads science fiction. He had tweeted at some point in there saying, yeah, it would be nice to... you know, reach. It would be nice to read a novel about a utopia that isn't entirely, you know, secretly a horrible place.
Yes, of course.
And so, so this allowed me to get into questions of, the Prime Directive is brand new as of Strange New Worlds.
Yeah,
they're just dealing with certain issues for the first time. And I was able to say, okay, well, let's confront Pike and Spock with situations where, and Una's in there as well, but she's removed from the action where these decisions are taking place, where Pike and Spock are having to look at things and saying, okay, how moral is it, or is it right for us to interact with this civilization at all, and is it right for us to make changes here that may benefit us elsewhere in the galaxy, but will ruin things here. Yes. You know, where do our rights begin? Do we have any rights? And you know, I have what I feel are, you know, some of the core exchanges of the book. You know, when I have basically the wagon train being pursued that's in the book, and you know, Pike is speaking to a, you know, what is essentially a 19th century journalist who's using a fun method I came up with to be able to communicate with Enterprise with no modern technology whatsoever. And he's having to send instructions up to Enterprise saying, okay, look, you can't do this. You can't do this. You can't do this. You can't do this. Every one of these things is in addition to these people's knowledge. You know, but wait, this place is the way it is because of other interference over here. Okay, well, the Prime Directive allows me to undo some things, but it doesn't allow me to undo everything.
Yes.
And I felt, okay, this is the Star Trekkiest novel I think I've ever done. you know, I've joked about Enterprise War, or not Enterprise War, but I've joked about the Rogue Elements, that it's the Star Warsiest novel I've ever done, because, you know, honestly, you know, he's Han Solo, except he smokes more, drinks more, and has a more active social life.
Now, hang on a second as well, John. I have to call out one thing here. If you recall, you did do a Star Trek story that was then repurposed as a Star Wars story.
Well,
I think we're okay.
Yeah, but, well, actually, it wasn't. Well, actually, I can say what that was. Because there was a Bynar in the SCE cast, mm-hmm. and he was going to get trapped on a planet again. Where they had basically Middle Ages technology, and what he was able to do was he was able to set up a group of semaphore stations that were able to signal the ship from the ground. So what I did is in Lost Tribe of the Sith, I did a story called Pandemonium, where I decided, okay, I want to use these semaphore stations, but it's going to actually be people using the Force to communicate with each other from one station to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. And so, because I didn't even have that level of technology on this planet. Well, like Lost Tribe of the Sith, we're trapped on a planet with no technology in Strange New Worlds, but also like Lost Tribe of the Sith, we've got maps. And that was another fun thing about this book. I was able to actually show. I was actually able to show Lost Tribe of the Sith to one of the folks at Paramount in the beginning and say, "Hey, look, let's we've done maps in these books. This is a map about a planet. Let's do maps." And we ended up doing 5 maps, which is really cool. And I'm just so happy that we were able to do it. But
fantastic stuff.
It is the first Star Trek novel with maps. Since A Stitch in Time, 23 years ago, which just has a couple of maps of the Cardassian capital city.
So, John, what's in the future now for you? So obviously you've got The Living Force is coming out in 2024. What else is in the plan? And do you hope to do more Star Trek? Or is that something you can't tell me right now?
I'm on several projects that I cannot mention right now. And I cannot even say what franchises. And I cannot even say what media. I can say it's more than one medium. I can't say that. I've got obviously The Living Force. This is a Star Wars novel that takes place a year before The Phantom Menace. So I've really been brought full circle to this. And it's really kind of spring break for the Jedi Council. I get to show everybody on the Jedi Council. And I will say and have said, I could not have written this novel had it not been for the Star Trek books, where I got to juggle very large crews, very large casts. I figured out exactly how to streamline the story. So, it covers all the ground that I need it to. That comes out April 9th in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook. I have a number of reprint items that are coming out. The Knight Errant novel comes out again in the Essential Collection. That is the trade paperback version. The Star Wars Legends novels are all slowly coming back out as trade paperbacks. And so that will be great because Marvel just put out my Knight Errant Star Wars comics in a big trade paperback this year. So people will be able to get both of those in new editions. Got a book actually came in here this weekend that I don't know when people are going to get to see it. They have seen the comic book version of it, but the graphic novel version of it. I've done a lot of video game comics work over the year and some short stories. I've done Mass Effect, we've mentioned Halo, various other things. There's a game from Ubisoft called Skull and Bones.
Yes, I've heard of it. Yeah.
Pirate ship game. And my friend James Mishler and I, who's a game designer, he actually worked with me on the maps that are in the Strange New Worlds book. We co-wrote a comic series about this game that takes place, with the characters and the milieu from the game. Yeah. And it came out this spring, the comic series. The graphic novel, however, is waiting until the video game comes out. The video game is not out yet. So the last I read on the internet is it's probably in the spring. But once that comes out, that will be another product with my name on it. And then finally, that very first Star Wars story I did, that one issue of Star Wars Empire that was kind of my audition, that will come out in one of these giant omnibus editions like I've got back here. That comes out, I think, in May, might be April, I'm not sure. But again, that's another reprint coming out. Beyond that, you know, my passport is still stamped. I was doing Star Wars short stories and a novella and things like that, you know, even during the whole Star Trek, you know, 8 novels in a row. I will never stray far from the franchises that I work with as long as they'll have me.
John, as I said, you're an absolutely wonderful nerd in the absolute best possible way, and I'm going to leave you with this last question, which we always ask guests, which is, what does, and I feel bad I'm actually limiting this question, but unfortunately I have to, what does Star Trek mean to you?
Star Trek is a vision of the future, which, you know, posits for folks not necessarily a utopia, but it does show us that we have a future. It does show us what things could be if we settle our differences and create warp drive. It does give us, like all science fiction does, a way to discuss some of the thornier issues of society, the thornier issues of politics, the thornier issues of other things, at this safe remove where, you know, we're the same way that in the 60s they were able to, you know, use Klingons and Romulans so as not to have to use world events, but you could still actually tell stories and have deep thoughts about things, and you know, you can get very deep thoughts from some of these shows. I mean, you know, the episode "Rightful Heir" in Next Generation. I remember the last scene of that where Worf is talking to the Emperor of the Clone Emperor. And they're getting into this discussion of, you know, what does it matter whether he's the clone or not if the words have value?
Yeah.
And I looked at that and I said, first of all, this is astonishingly deep for a show that is on syndicated television here, you know, probably coming on right before Baywatch. And this is astonishing. And it was something that was of such interest to me that when I wrote the Prey trilogy, I brought the Clone Emperor back to really elaborate on these things. And then I brought him back again in Picard, or actually I brought it's not the Clone Emperor. It's actually the holographic version of the original. Yeah. And again, we delve into some of these questions with him. There's just this wonderful moment where Rios says to the holographic Kalis, creating a holographic version of you for your people must just be horribly sacrilegious to the other Klingons, and the hologram says, yes, maybe, but you know, the old man who created me never harmed anybody. And if this is what he needs, I will fill that role with honor. To give this character some solace. So these are not conversations that people are having about Baywatch.
Know that, John. There could be a massive Baywatch podcast what does Baywatch mean to you? You know that, right?
I found that there are just absolute, you know, I don't read fan fiction for the reason that I'm not really allowed to, but I have discovered that there are just worlds upon worlds of things that are written of things nobody would imagine that would have spawned this kind of thing. But I think that, you know, Star Trek gives us a common cast to put in these situations, a common situation to depict in which to place these stories. And in so doing, it allows you to tell these kinds of stories to a bigger audience than you might otherwise get to if you were just doing it on your own. And so, you know, this is one of the things that keeps drawing me back to these worlds is the kinds of stories that they allow me to tell.
Brilliant stuff. John Jackson Miller, thank you so much for coming on our show this week. So guys, that is our episode this week. Thank you so much. Thank you again to John. I've been your host, Joe Hurley, and we'll be back again next week with another episode of The War Room. Until then, I've been your host, Joe Hurley. And again, John, thank you so much for coming on.
May the Force live long and prosper.
Thanks, guys.